snacks. It was a life lived in the trenches. Too much of it was waiting and listening. And all along she had thought that things would begin to smooth out when Tad was older. The discovery that it wasn't true brought on a kind of low-level horror. This past year he had been out of the house 3 mornings a week at Jack and Jill Nursery School. This summer it had been 5 afternoons a week at play camp. When he was gone, the house seemed shockingly empty. Doorways leaned and gaped with no Tad to fill them. The staircase yawned with no Tad halfway up, sitting there in his pajama bottoms before his nap, owlishly looking at one of his picture books. Doors were mouths, stairways throats. Empty rooms became traps. So she washed floors that didn't need to be washed. She watched the soaps. She thought about Steve Kemp, with whom she'd had a little flirtation since he had rolled into town the previous fall with Virginia license plates on his van and had set up a small stripping and refinishing business. She had caught herself sitting in front of the TV with no idea what was going on, because she had been thinking about the way his deep tan contrasted with his tennis whites, or the way his ass pumped when he moved fast. And finally, she had done something. And today, she felt her stomach knot up, and she ran for the bathroom, her hands plastered to her mouth, her eyes wide and starry. She made it, barely, and tossed up everything. She looked at the mess she had made, and with a groan she did it again. When her stomach felt better, but her legs were all a-tremble again, something lost, something gained, she looked at herself in the bathroom mirror. Her face was thrown into hard and unflattering relief by the fluorescent bar. Her skin was too white, her eyes red-rimmed. Her hair was plastered to her skull in an unflattering helmet. She saw what she was going to look like when she was old. And the most terrifying thing of all was that right now, if Steve Kemp was here, she thought she would let him make love to her if he would only hold her and kiss her and say that she didn't have to be afraid, that time was a myth and death was a dream, that everything was okay. A sound came out of her, a screaming sob that could surely not have been born in her chest. It was the sound of a madwoman. She lowered her head and cried. Charity Camber sat on the double bed she shared with her husband Joe and looked down at something she held in her hands. She had just come back from the store, the same one Donna Trenton patronized. Now her hands and feet and cheeks felt numb and cold, as if she had been out with Joe on the snowmobile for too long. But tomorrow was the 1st of July. The snowmobile was put neatly away in the back shed with its tarp snugged down. It can't be. There's been some mistake. But there was no mistake. She had checked 6 times, and there was no mistake. After all, it has to happen to somebody, doesn't it? Yes, of course. To somebody. But to her? She could hear Joe pounding on something in his garage, a high belling sound that beat its way into the hot afternoon like a hammer shaping thin metal. There was a pause, and then faintly, shit! The hammer struck once more, and there was a longer pause. Then her husband hollered, Brett! She always cringed a little when he raised his voice that way and yelled for their boy. Brett loved his father very much, but Charity had never been sure just how Joe felt about his son. That was a dreadful thing to be thinking, but it was true. Once, about 2 years ago, she had had a horrible nightmare, one she didn't think she would ever forget. She dreamed that her husband drove a pitchfork directly into Brett's chest. The tines went right through him and poked out the back of Brett's T-shirt, holding it out the way tent poles hold a tent up in the air.
"Little sucker didn't come when I hollered him down," her dream husband said.
And she had awakened with a jerk beside her real husband, who had been sleeping the sleep of beer beside her in his boxer shorts. The moonlight had been falling through the window and onto the bed where she now sat, moonlight in a cold and uncaring flood of light. And she had understood just how afraid a person could be, how fear was a monster with yellow teeth set afoot by an angry god to eat the unwary and the unfit. Joe had used his hands on her a few times in the course of their marriage, and she had learned. She wasn't a genius, maybe, but her mother hadn't raised any fools. Now she did what Joe told her and rarely argued. She guessed Brett was that way, too. But she feared for the boy sometimes. She went to the window in time to see Brett run across the yard and into the barn. Cujo trailed at Brett's heels, looking hot and dispirited. Faintly,
"Hold this for me, Brett."
More faintly,
"Sure, Daddy."
The hammering started again, that merciless ice-pick sound, whing, whing, whing. She imagined Brett holding something against something. A cold chisel against a frozen bearing, maybe, or a square spike against a lock bolt. Her husband, a pell-mell jittering in the corner of his thin mouth, his T-shirt sleeves rolled up, swinging a 5-pound pony hammer. And if he was drunk, if his aim was a little off. In her mind, she could hear Brett's agonized howl as the hammer mashed his hand to a red splintered pulp, and she crossed her arms over her bosom against the vision. She looked at the thing in her hand again and wondered if there was a way she could use it. More than anything in the world, she wanted to go to Connecticut to see her sister Holly. It had been 6 years now, in the summer of 1974. She remembered well enough because it had been a bad summer for her, except for that one pleasant weekend. 74 had been the year Brett's night problems had begun. Restlessness, bad dreams, and more frequently, incidents of sleepwalking. It was also the year Joe began drinking heavily. Brett's uneasy nights and his somnambulism had eventually gone away. Joe's drinking had not. Brett had been 4 then. He was 10 now, and didn't even remember his Aunt Holly, who had been married for 6 years. She had a little boy named after her husband and a little girl. Charity had never seen either child, her own niece and nephew, except for the Kodachromes Holly occasionally sent in the mail. She had gotten scared of asking Joe. He was tired of hearing her talk about it, and if she asked him again, he might hit her. It had been almost 16 months since she'd last asked him if maybe they couldn't take a little vacation down Connecticut way. Not much of a one for traveling was Mrs. Camber's son, Joe. He liked it just fine in Castle Rock. Once a year, he and that old tosspot Gary Pervier and some of their cronies would go up north to Moosehead to shoot deer. Last November, he had wanted to take Brett. She had put her foot down, and it had stayed down, in spite of Joe's sullen mutterings and Brett's wounded eyes. She was not going to have the boy out with that bunch of men for 2 weeks, listening to a lot of vulgar talk and jokes about sex and seeing what animals men could turn into when they got to drinking nonstop over a period of days and weeks. All of them with loaded guns walking in the woods. Loaded guns, loaded men. Somebody always got hurt sooner or later, fluorescent orange hats and vests or not. It wasn't going to be Brett, not her son. The hammer struck the steel steadily, rhythmically. It stopped. She relaxed a little. Then it started again. She supposed that sooner or later Brett would go with them, and that would be the end of him for her. He would join their club, and ever after she would be little more than a kitchen drudge that kept the clubhouse neat. Yes, that day would come, and she knew it, and she grieved for it. But at least she had been able to stave it off for another year. And this year, would she be able to keep him home with her this November? Maybe not. Either way, it would be better, not all right, but at least better if she could take Brett down to Connecticut first, take him down there and show him how some—oh, say it, if only to yourself—how some decent people lived. If Joe would let them go alone—but there was no sense thinking of that. Joe could go places alone or with his friends, but she couldn't, not even with Brett in tow. That was one of their marriage's ground rules. Yet she couldn't help thinking about how much better it would be without him, sitting in Holly's kitchen swilling beer, looking Holly's gym up and down with those insolent brown eyes. It would be better without him being impatient to be gone until Holly and Jim were also impatient for them to be gone. She and Brett, just the two of them. They could go on the bus. She thought, last November, he wanted to take Brett hunting with him. She thought, could a trade be worked out? Cold came to her, filling the hollows of her bones with spun glass. Would she actually agree to such a trade? He could take Brett to Moosehead with him in the fall, if Joe, in his turn, would agree to let them go to Stratford on the bus. There was money enough. Now there was. But money alone wouldn't do it. He'd take the money, and that would be the last she would see of it. Unless she played her cards just right. Just right. Her mind began to move faster. The pounding outside stopped. She saw Brett leave the barn trotting and was dimly grateful. Some premonitory part of her was convinced that if the boy ever came to serious harm, it would be in that dark place with the sawdust spread over the old grease on the plank floor. There was a way. There must be a way. If she was willing to gamble. In her fingers, she held a lottery ticket. She turned it over and over in her hand as she stood at the window, thinking. When Steve Kemp got back to his shop, he was in a kind of furious ecstasy. His shop was on the western outskirts of Castle Rock on Route 11. He had rented it from a farmer who had holdings in both Castle Rock and in neighboring Bridgeton. The farmer was not just a nerd, he was a super nerd. The shop was dominated by Steve's stripping vat, a corrugated iron pot that looked big enough to boil an entire congregation of missionaries at one time. Sitting around it like small satellites around a large planet was his work, bureaus, dressers, china cupboards, bookcases, tables. The air was aromatic with varnish, stripping compound, linseed oil. He had a fresh change of clothes in a battered TWA flight bag. He had planned to change after making love to the fancy cunt. Now he hurled the bag across the shop. It bounced off the far wall and landed on top of a dresser. He walked across to it and batted it aside. He drop-kicked it as it came down, and it hit the ceiling before falling on its side like a dead woodchuck. Then he simply stood, breathing hard, inhaling the heavy smells, staring vacantly at three chairs he had promised to Kane by the end of the week. His thumbs were jammed into his belt. His fingers were curled into fists. His lower lip was pooched out. He looked like a kid sulking after a bawling out.
"Cheap shit," he breathed, and went after the flight bag.
He made as if to kick it again, then changed his mind and picked it up. He went through the shed and into the three-room house that adjoined the shop. If anything, it was hotter in the house. Crazy July heat. It got in your head. The kitchen was full of dirty dishes. Flies buzzed around a green plastic hefty bag filled with beefaroni and tuna fish cans. The living room was dominated by a big old Zenith black-and-white TV he had rescued from the Naples dump. A big spayed brindle cat, name of Bernie Carbo, slept on top of it like a dead thing. The bedroom was where he worked on his writing. The bed itself was a rollaway, not made, the sheets stiff with cum. No matter how much he was getting, and over the last 2 weeks that had been zero, he masturbated a great deal. Masturbation, he believed, was a sign of creativity. Across from the bed was his desk. A big old-fashioned Underwood sat on top of it. Manuscripts were stacked to both sides. More manuscripts, some in boxes, some secured with rubber bands, were piled up in one corner. He wrote a lot, and he moved around a lot, and his main luggage was his work. Mostly poems, a few stories, a surreal play in which the character spoke a grand total of 9 words, and a novel he had attacked badly from 6 different angles. It had been 5 years since he had lived in one place long enough to get completely unpacked. Last December, while shaving one day, he had discovered the first threads of gray in his beard. The discovery had thrown him into a savage depression, and he had stayed depressed for weeks. He hadn't touched a razor between then and now, as if it was the act of shaving that had somehow caused the gray to show up. He was 38. He refused to entertain the thought of being that old. But sometimes it crept up on his blind side and surprised him. To be that old, less than 700 days shy of 40, terrified him. He had really believed that 40 was for other people. "That bitch," he thought over and over again, "that bitch." He had left dozens of women since he had first gotten laid by a vague, pretty, softly helpless French substitute when he was a high school junior. But he himself had only been dropped 2 or 3 times. He was good at seeing the drop coming and opting out of the relationship first. It was a protective device, like bombing the Queen of Spades on someone else in a game of hearts. You had to do it while you could still cover the bitch, or you got screwed. You covered yourself. That way, you didn't think about your age. He had known Donna was cooling it, but she had struck him as a woman who could be manipulated with no great difficulty, at least for a while, by a combination of psychological and sexual factors. By fear, if you wanted to be crude. That it hadn't worked that way left him feeling hurt and furious, as if he had been whipped raw. He got out of his clothes, tossed his wallet and change onto his desk, went into the bathroom, showered. When he came out, he felt a little better. He dressed again, pulling jeans and a faded chambray shirt from the flight bag. He picked his change up, put it in a front pocket, and paused, looking speculatively at his Lord Buxton. Some of the business cards had fallen out. They were always doing that, because there were so many of them. Steve Kemp had a pack rat sort of wallet. One of the items he almost always picked up and tucked away were business cards. They made nice bookmarks, and the space on the blank flip side was just right for jotting an address, simple directions, or a phone number. He would sometimes take 2 or 3 if he happened to be in a plumbing shop or if an insurance salesman stopped by. Steve would unfailingly ask the 9-to-5er for his card with a big, shit-eating grin. When he and Donna were going at it hot and heavy, he had happened to notice one of her husband's business cards lying on top of the TV. Donna had been taking a shower or something. He had taken the business card. No big reason, just the pack rat thing. Now he opened his wallet and thumbed through the cards, cards from prudential agents in Virginia, realtors in Colorado, a dozen businesses in between. For a moment he thought he had lost Handsome Hubby's card, but it had just slipped down between a couple of dollar bills. He fished it out and looked at it. White card, blue lettering done in modish lower case. Mr. Businessman Triumphant. Quiet, but impressive. Nothing flashy. Roger Breakstone, AdWorks, Victor Trenton. 1633 Congress Street, Telex AdWorks, Portland, Maine, 04001. Telephone 207-799-8600. Steve pulled a sheet of paper from a ream of cheap Mimeo stuff and cleared a place in front of him. He looked briefly at his typewriter. No. Each machine's typescript was as individual as a fingerprint. It was his crooked lowercase A that hung the blighter, Inspector. The jury was only out long enough to have tea. This would not be a police matter. No how, no way. But caution came without even thinking. Cheap paper available at any office supply store. No typewriter. He took a Pilot razor point from the coffee can on the corner of the desk and printed in large block letters. Hello, Vic. Nice wife you've got there. I enjoyed fucking the shit out of her. He paused, tapping the pen against his teeth. He was starting to feel good again. On top. Of course, she was a good-looking woman, and he supposed there was always the possibility that Trenton might discount what he had written so far. Talk was cheap, and you could mail someone a letter for less than the price of a coffee. But there was something, always something. What might it be? He smiled suddenly. When he smiled that way, his entire face lit up, and it was easy to see why he had never had much trouble with women since the evening with the vague, pretty French sub. He wrote, "What's that mole just above her pubic hair look like to you? To me it looks like a question mark. Do you have any questions?" That was enough. A meal is as good as a feast, his mother had always said. He found an envelope and put the message inside. After a pause, he slipped the business card in and addressed the envelope, also in block letters, to Vic's office. After a moment's thought, he decided to show the poor slob a little mercy and added personal below the address. He propped the letter on the windowsill and leaned back in his chair, feeling totally good again. He would be able to write tonight. He felt sure of it. Outside, a truck with out-of-state plates pulled into his driveway, a pickup with a great big Hoosier cabinet in the back. Someone had picked up a bargain at a barn sale. Lucky them. Steve strolled out. He would be glad to take their money and their Hoosier cabinet, but he really doubted if he would have time to do the work. Once that letter was mailed, a change of air might be in order. But not too big a change, at least not for a while. He felt he owed it to himself to stay in the area long enough to make at least one more visit to little Miss High Pockets. When it could be ascertained that Handsome Hubby was definitely not around, of course. Steve had played tennis with the guy, and he was no ball of fire. Thin, heavy glasses, spaghetti backhand. But you never knew when a handsome hubby was going to go off his gourd and do something antisocial. A good many handsome hubbies kept guns around the house, so he would want to check out the scene carefully before popping in. He would allow himself the one single visit, and then close this show entirely. He would maybe go to Ohio for a while, or Pennsylvania, or Taos, New Mexico. But like a practical joker who had stuffed a load into someone's cigarette, he wanted to stick around at a prudent distance, of course, and watch it blow up. The driver of the pickup and his wife were peering into the shop to see if he was there. Steve strolled out, hands in the pockets of his jeans, smiling. The woman smiled back immediately. "Hi, folks. Can I help you?" he asked, and thought that he would mail the letter as soon as he could get rid of them. That evening, as the sun went down red and round and hot in the west, Vic Trenton, his shirt tied around his waist by the arms, was looking into the engine compartment of his wife's Pinto. Donna was standing beside him, looking young and fresh in a pair of white shorts and a red-checked sleeveless blouse. Her feet were bare. Tad, dressed only in his bathing suit, was driving his trike madly up and down the driveway, playing some sort of mind game that apparently had Ponch and John from Chips pitted against Darth Vader. "Drink your iced tea before it melts," Donna told Vic.
"Uh-huh."
The glass was on the side of the engine compartment. Vic had a couple of swallows, put it back without looking, and it tumbled off into his wife's hand.
"Hey," he said. "Nice catch."
She smiled. "I just know you when your mind's somewhere else, that's all. Look, didn't spill a drop." They smiled into each other's eyes for a moment. A good moment, Vic thought. Maybe it was just his imagination or wishful thinking, but lately it seemed there were more of the good small moments, less of the sharp words, fewer silences which were cold, or maybe this was worse, just indifferent. He didn't know what the cause was, but he was grateful.
"Strictly AAA Farm Club," he said. "You got a ways to go before you make the bigs, kid."
"So, what's wrong with my car, Coach?" He had the air cleaner off. It was sitting in the driveway.
"Never saw a Frisbee like that before," Tad had said matter-of-factly a few moments ago, swerving his trike around it.
Vic leaned back in and poked aimlessly at the carburetor with the head of his screwdriver.
"It's in the carb. I think the needle valve's sticking."
"That's bad?"
"Not too bad," he said. "But it can stop you cold if it decides to stick shut. The needle valve controls the flow of gas into the carb, and without gas, you don't go. It's like a national law, babe."
"Daddy, will you push me on the swing?"
"Yeah, in a minute."
"Good. I'll be in the back."
Tad started around the house toward the swing and gym set Vic had built last summer, while lubricating himself well with gin and tonics, working from a set of plans, doing it after supper on weeknights and on weekends with the voices of the Boston Red Sox announcers blaring from the transistor radio beside him. Tad, them three, sat solemnly on the cellar bulkhead or on the back steps, chin cupped in his hands, fetching things sometimes, mostly watching silently. Last summer. A good summer, not as beastly hot as this one. It had seemed then that Donna had finally adjusted and was seeing that Maine, Castle Rock, Adworks, those things could be good for all of them. Then the mystifying bad patch, the worst of it being that nagging, almost psychic feeling that things were even more wrong than he wanted to think about. Things in the house began to seem subtly out of place, as if unfamiliar hands had been moving them around. He had gotten the crazy idea—was it crazy?
that Donna was changing the sheets too often. They were always clean. And one night that old fairy tale question had popped into his mind, echoing unpleasantly, "Who's been sleeping in my bed?" Now things had loosened up, it seemed. If not for the crazy raspberry zingers business and the rotten trip hanging over his head, he would feel that this could be a pretty good summer, too. It might even turn out that way. You won sometimes. Not all hopes were vain. He believed that, although his belief had never been seriously tested. "Tad," Donna yelled, bringing the boy to a screeching halt, "put your trike in the garage."
"Mommy?"
"Now, please, monsieur." "Monsieur," Tad said and laughed into his hands.
"You didn't put your car away, Mom."
"Daddy is working on my car."
"Yeah, but..."
"Mind your mom, Tadder," Vic said, picking up the air cleaner. "I'll be around shortly." Tad mounted his trike and drove into the garage, accompanying himself with a loud, ululating ambulance wail.
"Why are you putting it back on?" Donna asked. "Aren't you going to fix it?"
"It's a precision job," Vic said. "I don't have the tools. Even if I did, I'd probably make it worse instead of better."
"Damn," she said morosely and kicked a tire. "These things never happen until the warranty runs out, do they?"
The Pinto had just over 20,000 miles on it and was still 6 months from being theirs free and clear.
"That's like a national law, too," Vic said.
He put the air cleaner back on its post and tightened the butterfly nut.
"I guess I can run over to South Paris while Tad's in his day camp. I'll have to get a loaner, though, with you being gone. Will it get me to South Paris, Vic?"
"Sure. But you don't have to do that. Take it out to Joe Camber's place. That's only 7 miles, and he does good work. Remember when that wheel bearing went on the jag? He took it out with a chain fall made out of old lengths of telephone pole and charged $10. Man, if I'd gone to that place in Portland, they would have mounted my checkbook like a moose head."
"That guy made me nervous," Donna said. "Aside from the fact that he was about 2.5 sheets to the wind, I mean."
"How did he make you nervous?"
"Busy eyes."
Vic laughed. "Honey, with you, there's a lot to be busy about."
"Thank you," she said. "A woman doesn't necessarily mind being looked at. It's being mentally undressed that makes you nervous."
She paused, strangely, he thought, looking away at the grim red light in the west. Then she looked back at him.
"Some men give you the feeling that there's a little movie called The Rape of the Sabine Women going on in their heads all the time. And you just got the starring role."
He had that curious, unpleasant feeling that she was talking about several things at once. Again. But he didn't want to get into that tonight, not when he was finally crawling out from under a shit heap of a month. Babe, he's probably completely harmless. He's got a wife, a kid.
Yes. Probably he is. But she crossed her arms over her breasts and cupped her elbows in her palms, a characteristic gesture of nervousness with her.
"Look," he said, "I'll run your Pinto up there this Saturday and leave it if I have to, okay? More likely he'll be able to get right to it. I'll have a couple of beers with him and pat his dog. You remember that St. Bernard?"
Donna grinned.
"I even remember his name. He practically knocked Tad over, licking him. You remember?"
Vic nodded.
"The rest of the afternoon, Tad goes around after him saying, 'Cujo! Here, Cujo!'"
They laughed together.
"I feel so
damn stupid sometimes, Donna said. If I could use a standard shift, I could just run the jag while you're gone.
You're just as well off. The jag's eccentric. You gotta talk to it.
He slammed the hood of the Pinto back down.
Ooh, you dummy, she moaned. Your iced tea glass was in there.
And he looked so comically surprised that she went off into gales of laughter. After a minute, he joined her. Finally, it got so bad that they had to hang on to each other like a couple of drunks. Tad came back around the house to see what was going on, his eyes round. At last, convinced that they were mostly all right in spite of the nutty way they were acting, he joined them. This was about the same time that Steve Kemp mailed his letter, less than 2 miles away. Later, as dusk settled down and the heat slacked off a little and the first fireflies started to stitch seams in the air across the backyard, Vic pushed his son on the swing.
Higher, Daddy! Higher!
If you go any higher, you're gonna loop the loop, kid.
Get me under then, Dad. Get me under.
Vic gave Tad a huge push, propelling the swing toward the sky where the first stars were just beginning to appear, and ran all the way under the swing. Tad screamed joyfully, his head tilted back, his hair blowing.
That was good, Daddy! Get me under again!
Vic gave his son under again, from the front this time, and Tad went soaring into the still, hot night. Aunt Evie Chalmers lived close by, and Tad's shouts of terrified glee were the last sounds she heard as she died. Her heart gave out, one of its paper-thin walls breaching suddenly and almost painlessly, as she sat in her kitchen chair, a cup of coffee by one hand, and a straight 8 Herbert Tarryton by the other. She leaned back, and her vision darkened, and somewhere she heard a child crying. And for a moment, it seemed that the cries were joyful. But as she went out, suddenly propelled as if by a hard but not unkind push from behind, it seemed to her that the child was screaming in fear, in agony. Then she was gone, and her niece Abby would find her the following day, her coffee as cold as she was, her cigarette a perfect and delicate tube of ash, her lower plate protruding from her wrinkled mouth like a slot filled with teeth. Just before Tad's bedtime, he and Vic sat on the back stoop. Vic had a beer, Tad had milk.
Daddy?
What?
I wish you didn't have to go away next week.
I'll be back.
Yeah, but...
Tad was looking down, struggling with tears. Vic put a hand on his neck.
But what, big guy?
Who's gonna say the words that keep the monster out of the closet? Mommy doesn't know them. Only you know them.
Now the tears spilled over and ran down Tad's face.
Is that all? Vic asked.
The monster words, Vic had originally dubbed them the Monster Catechism, but Tad had trouble with that word, so it had been shortened, had come about in late spring, when Tad began to be afflicted with bad dreams and night fears. There was something in his closet, he said. Sometimes at night his closet door would swing open, and he would see it in there, something with yellow eyes that wanted to eat him up. Donna had thought it might have been some fallout from Maurice Sendak's book Where the Wild Things Are. Vic had wondered aloud to Roger, but not to Donna, if maybe Tad had picked up a garbled account of the mass murders that had taken place in Castle Rock and had decided that the murderer, who had become a kind of town boogeyman, was alive and well in his closet. Roger said he supposed it was possible. With kids, anything was possible. And Donna herself had begun to get a little spooked after a couple of weeks of this. She told Vic one morning in a kind of laughing, nervous way that things in Tad's closet sometimes appeared moved around.
Well, Tad did it, Vic had responded.
You don't understand, Donna said. He doesn't go back there anymore, Vic. Never. He's scared to.
And she had added that sometimes it seemed to her that the closet actually smelled bad after Tad's bouts of nightmare followed by waking fear. Like an animal had been caged up in there. Disturbed, Vic had gone into the closet and sniffed. In his mind was a half-formed idea that perhaps Tad was sleepwalking, perhaps going into his closet and urinating in there as a part of some odd dream cycle. He had smelled nothing but mothballs. The closet, finished wall on one side and bare lathing on the other, stretched back some 8 feet. It was as narrow as a Pullman car. There was no boogeyman back in there, and Vic most certainly did not come out in Narnia. He got a few cobwebs in his hair. That was all. Donna had suggested first what she called good dream thoughts to combat Tad's night fears. Then prayer. Tad responded to the former by saying that the thing in his closet stole his good dream thoughts. He responded to the latter by saying that since God didn't believe in monsters, prayers were useless. Her temper had snapped, perhaps partly because she had been spooked by Tad's closet herself. Once, while hanging some of Tad's shirts in there, the door had swung quietly shut behind her, and she'd had a bad 40 seconds fumbling her way back to the door and getting out. She had smelled something in there that time. Something hot and close and violent. A matted smell. It reminded her a little of Steve Kemp's sweat after they finished making love. The upshot was her curt suggestion that, since there were no such things as monsters, Tad should put the whole thing out of his mind, hug his teddy, and go to sleep. Vic either saw more deeply or remembered more clearly about the closet door that turned into an unhinged idiot mouth in the dark of night, a place where strange things sometimes rustled, a place where hanging clothes sometimes turned into hanging men. He remembered vaguely about the shadows the streetlight could throw on the wall in the endless 4 hours that followed the turn of the day, and the creaking sounds that might have been the house settling, or that might, just might, be something creeping up. His solution had been the monster catechism, or just the monster words if you were four and not much into semantics. Either way, it was nothing more nor less than a primitive incantation to keep evil at bay. Vic had invented it one day on his lunch hour, and to Donna's mixed relief and chagrin, it worked when her own efforts to use psychology, parent effectiveness training, and finally blunt discipline had failed. Vic spoke it over Tad's bed every night like a benediction, as Tad lay there naked under a single sheet in the sweltering dark. "Do you think that's going to do him any good in the long run?" Donna asked. Her voice held both amusement and irritation. This had been in mid-May, when the tensions between them had been running high. "Ad men don't care about the long run," Vic had answered. "They care about fast, fast, fast relief. And I'm good at my job."
"Yeah. Nobody to say the monster words. That's the matter. That's a lot the matter,"
Tad answered now, wiping the tears off his cheeks in disgust and embarrassment.
"Well, listen," Vic said. "They're written down. That's how I can say them the same every night. I'll print them on a piece of paper and tack them to your wall, and Mommy can read them to you every night I'm gone."
"Yeah? Will you?"
"Sure, said I would."
"You won't forget."
"No way, man. I'll do it tonight."
Tad put his arms around his father, and Vic hugged him tight. That night, after Tad slept, Vic went quietly into the boy's room and tacked a sheet of paper to the wall with a pushpin. He put it right next to Tad's Mighty Marvel calendar, where the kid couldn't miss it. Printed in large clear letters on this sheet of paper was, "The Monster Words, for Tad." "Monsters, stay out of this room. You have no business here. No monsters under Tad's bed. You can't fit under there. No monsters hiding in Tad's closet. It's too small in there. No monsters outside of Tad's window. You can't hold on out there. No vampires, no werewolves, no things that bite. You have no business here. Nothing will touch Tad or hurt Tad all this night. You have no business here." Vic looked at this for a long time and reminded himself to tell Donna at least twice more before he left to read it to the kid every night, to impress on her how important the monster words were to Tad. On his way out, he saw the closet door was open, just a crack. He closed the door firmly and left his son's room. Sometime much later that evening, the door swung open again. Heat lightning flickered sporadically, tattooing crazy shadows in there. But Tad did not wake. The next day, at 7:15 in the morning, Steve Kemp's van backed out onto Route 11. Steve made miles, heading for Route 302. There he would turn left and drive southeast, crossing the state to Portland. He intended to flop at the Portland YMCA for a while. On the van's dashboard was a neat pile of addressed mail, not printed in block letters this time, but typed on his own machine. The typewriter was now in the back of the van, along with the rest of his stuff. It had taken him only an hour and a half to pack in his Castle Rock operation, including Bernie Carbo, who was now snoozing in his box by the rear doors. He and Bernie traveled light. The typing job on the envelopes was a professional one. 16 years of creative writing had turned him into an excellent typist, if nothing else. He pulled over to the same box from which he had posted the anonymous note to Vic Trenton the night before and dropped the letters in. It would not have bothered him in the least to run out owing rent on the shop and the house if he had intended to leave the state. But since he was only going as far as Portland, it seemed prudent to do everything legally. This time he could afford not to cut corners. There was better than $600 in cash tucked into the small bolt hole behind the van's glove compartment. In addition to a check covering the rent he owed, he was returning deposits to several people who had made them on bigger jobs. Accompanying each check was a polite note saying he was very sorry to have caused any inconvenience, but his mother had been taken suddenly and seriously ill. Every red-blooded American was a sucker for a mom story. Those for whom he had contracted to do work could pick up their furniture at the shop. The key was on the ledge above the door, just to the right, and would they kindly return the key to the same place after they made their pickup? Thank you, blah-de-blah, bullshit, bullshit. There would be some inconvenience, but no real hassle. Steve dropped the letters into the mailbox. There was that satisfied feeling of having his ass well covered. He drove away toward Portland, singing along with the Grateful Dead, who were delivering sugaree. He pushed the van up to 55, hoping traffic would stay light, so he could get to Portland early enough to grab a court at Tennis of Maine. All in all, it looked like a good day. If Mr. Businessman hadn't received his little letter bomb yet, he surely would today. Nifty, Steve thought, and burst out laughing. At 7:30, as Steve Kemp was thinking tennis and Vic Trenton was reminding himself to call Joe Camber about his wife's balky pinto, Charity Camber was fixing her son's breakfast. Joe had left for Lewiston 30 minutes ago, hoping to find a 72 Camaro windshield at one of the city's automobile junkyards or used parts outfits. This jibed well with Charity's plans, which she had made slowly and carefully. She put Brett's plate of scrambled eggs and bacon in front of him and then sat down next to the boy. Brett glanced up from the book he was reading in mild surprise. After fixing his breakfast, his mother usually started on her round of morning chores. If you spoke to her too much before she got herself around a second cup of coffee, she was apt to show you the rough side of her tongue.
"Can I talk to you a minute, Brett?"
Mild surprise turned to something like amazement. Looking at her, he saw something utterly foreign in his mother's taciturn nature. She was nervous. He closed his book and said, "Sure, Mom."
"Would you like..."
She cleared her throat and began again.
"How would you like to go down to Stratford, Connecticut, and see your Aunt Holly and your Uncle Jim and your cousins?"
Brett grinned. He had only been out of Maine twice in his life, most recently with his father on a trip to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They had gone to a used car auction where Joe had picked up a 58 Ford with a Hemi engine.
"Sure," he said.
"When?"
"I was thinking of Monday," she said. "After the weekend of the 4th. We'd be gone a week. Could you do that?"
"I guess. Geez, I thought Dad had a lot of work lined up for next week. He must have..."
"I haven't mentioned this to your father yet."
Brett's grin fell apart. He picked up a piece of bacon and began to eat it.
"Well, I know he promised Richie Sims he'd pull the motor on his international harvester, and Mr. Miller from the school was gonna bring over his Ford because the tranny's shot, and
I just thought the two of us would go," Charity said,
"on the Greyhound from Portland." Brett looked doubtful. Outside the back porch screen, Cujo padded slowly up the steps and collapsed onto the boards in the shade with a grunt. He looked in at the boy and the woman with weary, red-rimmed eyes. He was feeling very bad now. Very bad indeed.
"Geez, Mom, I don't know.
Don't say geez. It's just the same as swearing."
"Sorry.
Would you like to go? If your father said it was all right?"
"Yeah, really.
Do you really think we could?"
"Maybe." She was looking out through the window over the sink, thoughtfully.
"How far is it to Stratford, Mom?"
"About 350 miles, I guess."
"Gee, I mean, boy, that's a long way. Is it..."
"Brett?"
He looked at her attentively. That curious, intense quality was back in her voice and on her face, that nervousness.
"What, Mom?"
"Can you think of anything your father needs out in the shop? Any one thing he's been looking to get?"
The light dawned in Brett's eyes a little.
"Well, he always needs adjustable wrenches, and he's been wanting a new set of ball and sockets, and he could use a new welder's helmet since the old one got a crack in the faceplate.
No, I mean anything big. Expensive."
Brett thought a while, then smiled.
"Well, what he'd really like is to have a new Jurgen chainfall, I guess. Rip that old motor out of Richie Sims International just as slick as sh-" "Well, slick."
He blushed and hurried on.
"But you couldn't get him nothing like that, Mom. That's really dear."
Dear.
Joe's word for expensive. She hated it.
How much?
Well, the one in the catalog says $1,700, but Dad could probably get it from Mr. Belasco at Portland Machine for wholesale. Dad says Mr. Belasco's scared of him.
Do you think there's something smart about that? She asked sharply.
Brett sat back in his chair, a little frightened by her fierceness. He couldn't remember his mother ever acting quite like this. Even Cujo, out on the porch, pricked his ears a little.
Well, do you?
No, Mom, he said. But Charity knew in a despairing way that he was lying. If you could scare somebody into giving you wholesale, you were trading a right smart. She had heard the admiration in Brett's voice, even if the boy himself had not.
Wants to be just like him. Thinks his daddy is just standing tall when he scares someone. Oh, my God.
There's nothing smart about being able to scare people, Charity said. All it takes is a big voice and a mean disposition. There's no smart to it. She lowered her voice and flapped a hand at him. Go on and eat your eggs. I'm not going to shout at you.
I guess it's the heat.
He ate, but quietly and carefully, looking at her now and then. There were hidden mines around this morning.
What would wholesale be, I wonder? $1,300? $1,000?
I don't know, Mama.
Would this Belasco deliver on a big order like that?
Yeah, I guess he would. If we had that kind of money.
Her hand went to the pocket of her house dress. The lottery ticket was there. The green number on her ticket, 76, and the red number, 434, matched to the numbers drawn by the State Lottery Commission 2 weeks before. She had checked it dozens of times, unable to believe it. She had invested 50 cents that week, as she had done every week since the lottery began in 1975, and this time she had won $5,000. She hadn't cashed the ticket in yet, but neither had she let it out of her sight or her reach since she found out.
We do have that kind of money, she said.
Brett goggled at her.
At 10:15, Vic slipped out of his AdWorks office and went around to Bentley's for his morning coffee, unable to face the bitch's brew that was available at the office. He had spent the morning writing ads for DeCoster Egg Farms. It was hard going. He had hated eggs since his boyhood, when his mother grimly forced one down his throat 4 days a week. The best he had been able to come up with so far was Eggs Say Love, seamlessly. Not very good. Seamlessly had given him the idea of a trick photo which would show an egg with a zipper running around its middle. It was a good image, but where did it lead? No place that he had been able to discover. Ought to ask the Tadder, he thought, as the waitress brought him coffee and a blueberry muffin. Tad liked eggs. It wasn't really the egg ad that was bringing him down, of course. It was having to take off for 12 days. Well, it had to be. Roger had convinced him of that. They would have to get in there and pitch like hell. Good old garrulous Roger, whom Vic loved almost like a brother. Roger would have been more than glad to cruise down here to Bentley's with him, to have a coffee with him, and to talk his ear off. But this one time, Vic needed to be alone. To think. The two of them would be spending most of 2 weeks together starting Monday, sweating it out, and that was quite enough, even for soul brothers. His mind turned toward the Red Raspberry Zingers fiasco again, and he let it,
knowing that sometimes a no-pressure, almost idle review of a bad situation could, for him at least, result in some new insight. A fresh angle. What had happened was bad enough, and Zingers had been withdrawn from the market. Bad enough, but not terrible. It wasn't like that canned mushroom thing. No one had gotten sick or died, and even consumers realized that a company could take a pratfall now and then. Look at that McDonald's glass giveaway.